On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Julie Bischel on how to conduct psychic medium research.
I think people fail to understand that proper research design includes optimizing the possibility of achieving positive results. If you wanted to study plant growth, you don't put a dry seed on the benchtop in the lab and then say, plants can't grow. And, you know, you use soil and water and sunlight, and then you study the growth of the seed.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. Okay, now on today's show, we're going to dig into the nuts and bolts of psychic medium research. And we're going to look back on some of what's been done in the past and the criticisms of it. And we're going to look forward to the kind of research we might do in the future in collaboration with open-minded skeptics like Ben Radford from the Skeptical Inquirer and Steve Novella from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And there's no better person to join us and help us in this than Julie Bischel from the Winbridge Institute in Tucson. And Julie, as many of you know from our previous interview with her, is researching medium communication as a way of answering, or at least examining, the bigger question of whether our consciousness survives death. So Julie, thanks for joining us again on Skeptico.
Thanks for having me.
As you know from the email dialogue we've had back and forth, we had Ben Radford on the last episode, and we wound up kind of wading into this whole issue of medium communication, and the work that you did with Gary Schwartz came up. And I think what I'd like to do is start with a quote from Ben that kind of summarizes his feelings about that research. And then I want you to respond in general. And I also want you to, and I think this is going to be interesting both to me and to our listeners, I want to work with you and go through the real timeline here of what we're talking about in terms of Gary's publication of the Afterlife Experiments books, then the response by Ray Hyman, Gary's response, and then you joining the team at University of Arizona and what y'all went through, some of the changes you made, and then your latest research. So let's kick that off by going back and listening again to what Ben had to say when he was on our show in the last episode.
Let me give you another example. Then, you know, Gary Schwartz's Afterlife Experiments. Gary Schwartz has published a couple books and studies that you know, in which he's claiming that there's strong evidence for communication with the afterlife. And Ray Hyman, who I'm sure you know, was a, you know, psychologist at the University of Oregon, an incredible statistician, went through and looked at Schwartz's claims, and he found serious methodological flaws in the analyses and the methodologies.
Okay, so a general response to that?
Well, that book was published before I started performing mediumship research at the U of A. In fact, before I even knew what a medium was. So I really can't comment on its content because I wasn't involved at all.
Okay, well then...
And like you said, there are several published critiques and responses if people are interested.
Here's what I was trying to get at, Julie. It sounds to me like, you know, the chronology that we're laying out here is this book comes out... Gary's getting some criticism, and as you've related to us in the previous interview, your meeting with Gary, or the chance meeting that you had, was really quite coincidental, and Gary saw in you the ability to maybe tighten up some protocols that he had and was developing and maybe was not spending as much time on as he should have. Certainly, your background would be someone that someone in Gary's position would immediately see the value of in terms of what he's doing. Can you tell us a little bit about, well, tell me if that's correct and how your background does fit with the kind of research that Gary was doing?
Well, I can't really speak to, you know, what he was thinking when he met me.
Sure.
But what was conveyed to me was because I had a strong background in methodological design in a, quote, hard science, they thought that would be Gary and the donor thought that would be helpful in the continuation of the research into, yes, tighter protocols.
because again, your background is pharmacology, where you're basically being trained to take new drugs and see if they're safe and effective, right?
Yeah. In essence, that's what pharmacology is.
So you and Gary started working together. When did you actually begin your research with Gary? When did you start developing a new protocol and then looking for participants and actually starting trials?
Well, when I first came on board, I wasn't very familiar with the field at all. And so he was sort of already in the process of asking questions like, does the sitter need to be there for a reading to be successful, or can a proxy sitter be serve in place of the sitter? Does that work? Can you ask the medium specific questions about the discarnate, or can it? Does it just need to be free form? So we did some of that, those sorts of studies at the beginning, and then once I was learning more and more about the field, it became my goal to statistically establish the existence of the phenomenon of mediumship itself in a contemporary laboratory with modern day mental mediums. I felt like maybe we had sort of skipped a couple steps ahead. Like we had, you know, we needed to back up to what we call the primary hypothesis, which is, can mediums do what they claim to be doing? So that's when we performed, designed and recruited subjects and performed the study that then went on to be published, the triple blind study. And so we nicknamed that the primary hypothesis study, or we also call it the AIR, which stands for anomalous information reception, which is what we call the phenomenon or process of mediumship.
Okay, so let's deconstruct that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You felt, and Gary felt obviously, that maybe what needed to be done is to back up and look at the underlying hypothesis, which is, how would you state the underlying hypothesis in kind of layman's terms?
I could probably say this in my sleep. So the primary hypothesis is, skilled mediums can report accurate and specific information about the deceased loved ones, termed discarnates, of living people, termed sitters, without any prior knowledge about the discarnates or the sitters, and in the complete absence of any sensory feedback.
So how do you think the work been done prior was not directly addressing that kind of underlying hypothesis? Where had we kind of ventured away from that a little bit?
Again, I wasn't around for that. That book came out in 2002, so the current research is well beyond those methods. In our lab and other work that's being done by, for instance, Archie Roy and Tricia Robertson in Scotland, and Emily Kelly and Diane Archangel at the University of Virginia. So, like, I don't think it's useful to sort of nitpick at that, because we're so far beyond it that it doesn't, you know, it's like saying, why did we think the Earth was flat? Well, it doesn't matter, because now we know that it's not.
You know, maybe. But, I mean, I think the part that I disagree with that is that the history of it, I don't think we have to run from. And again, I think the historical context that I would add to it is that, so if Gary Schwartz is the first one to, and he's not the first one, because there's a 100-year history of this.
Exactly.
But if he stumbles across this himself and is blown away by these readings, and he goes in and he does what he does in afterlife experiments, I think it's useful to look back and say, okay, objectively, where was that maybe stretching the boundaries of what we really thought we know, and where did we need to kind of pull in our ranks a little bit and go back to kind of the primary hypothesis that we're looking at? So I'm not really asking you to comment on the research per se, but more, why did you feel there was this need to, and we can move past this, but why was there a need to more tightly define the research hypothesis?
How about we can look at it, like you said, it's 100 years of research, so we can look at it sort of in a historical perspective. How did it used to be done, and what were the problems, and then how's the current research addressing those problems? So do you want to list those issues to me again, and I'll address those?
Fair enough. And I guess just to push that point a little bit further, I think that the way that you described it and the way that you went through your process there, described your process of going back and saying, okay, what is the primary hypothesis, I think is outstanding. And if you're recalling the interview that I had with Ben Radford last week, it's a mistake that skeptics make as well. So you're kind of saying, hey, I felt like maybe the lab was was pushing the boundaries a little bit further than we needed to. We needed to take a step back. Well, the same thing happens when you listen to skeptics. And what they'll do is when they get some data in that's uncomfortable, that pushes their boundaries, that, hey, maybe I'm not in solid ground, then they jump ahead and start asking hypothetical questions. Well, then why isn't the communication this way? Well, then why can't they answer this? Why can't they answer this? So what I want to really make clear is how important it is to be crystal clear and focused in the research hypothesis. And I think that's something that you and Gary did, to your credit, on this or second round or whatever round you wanted to call it that you did. So again, let's get back to the primary objections, I think, of that initial research from the University of Arizona. It was, number one, a judging bias. Number two, a control group bias. And number three, the ones that everyone really kind of grabs a hold of right off the bat, is sensory leakage. So do you want to go through those?
Yeah, let's go from the back end backwards. So sensory leakage, yeah, if the medium and the sitter are in the same room, obviously there's sensory leakage, even if you use a partition, because the medium can, as soon as the sitter says anything, the tone of voice, that even if the sitter just says yes or no, like you can say yes, you can say yes. You know, it's very different, and that gives a lot of information to the medium. So you can't have the medium and the sitter in the same room. There's always going to be sensory leakage. Even on the telephone, there's sensory leakage for those same reasons, where a lot of information comes through the sitter's voice. So in the current research, the sitter is not on the phone with the medium. It's just a proxy sitter. So I serve as the proxy sitter. And it's just the medium and I on the phone. And I don't know anything about the sitter or the deceased person.
Okay.
And then just the medium and I do a reading.
Okay, that's great. And I want to make that crystal clear. On the readings that you're doing now, the medium never talks to the person they're doing the reading for. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So that part is totally out of the equation.
Right.
And I want to just backtrack for a minute and point out that you're talking about it in very, very tight, scientifically controlled terms, which is great. But the counterclaim to that has never been proven either, as far as I know. And that's that sensory leakage, nonverbal cues, tone of voice can explain all the information that we know is passed between a reading. I'm not saying it is. I'm not saying it's not. But sometimes when we hear that skeptical counterclaim, we have to keep in mind that that is an equally unproven scientific claim. And in fact, cold reading demonstrations using the same kind of even lax controls that were used at the University of Arizona back in 2002 have never been done, showing that you can get the names of deceased relatives and be able to put all those together in a way that makes a meaningful reading. Now, there's no reason to go back and really try and recreate kind of a flawed protocol and see if it generates a good control to counter the work that was done. But I just feel a need to kind of point that out, because sometimes when we concede that we need to improve something, it's not conceding that the counterclaim has really been established. And I think in this case, it hasn't.
I would agree with that.
Let's move on and talk about control group bias.
Let's go to the other one, because this same idea controls for rater bias. Doesn't hear the reading as it takes place, then we can give the sitter two different readings to score without knowing which is which. And so they don't, that controls for rater bias, because the sitter doesn't know which reading is theirs, and they score one that's theirs and one that isn't with the same, you know, I don't know how you want to say it, amount of bias or level of bias. And it sort of washes it out then.
Let's break that down a little bit, because
okay.
I think it slipped past me the first time I ran across your research. I'm trying to think what's the best way to do this, whether we should, because we're kind of talking about the judging bias. Maybe mm-hmm. at this point it would be more useful to go through and very quickly go over your protocol, and then we can, it just becomes crystal clear to anyone who's objective that there cannot be any judging bias and there cannot be any control group bias. So why don't we start with going over how the protocol works?
Our current protocol uses a quintuple blind methodology. So there's five levels of blinding. And how we do it is we start with a group of sitters and we screen them, and they describe the one person they wish to hear from most that's deceased. And then we take those descriptions and we find pairs of deceased people who are the most opposite. And then that creates a pair of sitters. And then each medium reads a pair of sitters or a pair of discarnates. So, for example...
Okay, now hold on. Before you lose me and lose everybody else. So you start with all these potential people that would like to get a reading.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you do that's different from the prior research that was done at the University of Arizona, you narrow it down and you say, okay, I want you just to select one person that you specifically want to talk to on the other side, if you will.
Right.
One deceased person.
Mm-hmm.
So this prevents the kind of fishing around that makes everyone uncomfortable, both skeptics and believers, where the medium goes, it's maybe an aunt or it's maybe a grandmother or a friend and all this. Because now the medium is going to be tasked with just targeting in on one specific deceased person. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the other thing that you do here that I think is really, really significant, and it's brought up or kind of Ben Radford last week had a similar kind of thought without realizing that you had already done this in the research that you published more than a year and a half ago. And that's that you actually pre-select pairs of people based on how different the person that they're trying to connect with is.
Right. I think I wrote down a quote. I think this is close to what he said. He said, enough variation between subjects should exist so that meaningful distinctions between subjects can be made. That's exactly what we do.
So take us through like an example of how that would work.
So we pair the people to be most opposite in age, physical description, personality description, hobbies, cause of death.
Okay, so I come along and I'm a potential research participant and I say, gee, Julie, I'd really like to connect with my grandmother who passed away. And she passed away when she was 95 and she was a small woman in stature, 5'1". And she had olive skin, and her hobbies were going to church and knitting.
Okay. We would find another sitter who had a discarnate that was young and, you know, active and blonde and had died of an accident rather than, you know, if your grandmother died of old age, it was a slow process. So we pair the person to be most different on a variety. It's not just, you know, it's hair color and build and height and cause of death would be part of the body that was affected fast or slow, natural or unnatural. And then hobbies are inside or outside. And
okay. So we're picking up here. We had a little technical difficulty. And I think what you were going over was all the different factors that you consider in a reading anyway, and those are the ones that you kind of match for the maximum disparity possible. And the reason that you do that is because, tell us.
We pair a pair of discarnates to be most opposite, and then they're the same in gender, but most opposite in everything else. And then the same medium reads both people in the pair. And then each person, so if you said you wanted a reading from your grandmother and I wanted a reading from my sister, then a medium would do a reading for your grandmother and for my sister. And then I would score both readings and you would score both readings, but we wouldn't know which one was which because we weren't there when the readings took place. So that controls for rate or bias. And then we give a score. I give a score to each reading and you give a score to each reading in addition to item by item scoring. It's a very complicated scoring process. But then, so my score of your reading serves as a control and your score of my reading serves as a control. So then we statistically compare the scores given by the intended sitter to the intended reading and to the scores given by the control sitter to the control reading.
Awesome. Now let's back up because there's actually, and you're trying to make it as simple as possible, but there's a couple other steps that you go through there that are also interesting and noteworthy. So we'll put you in the place of the person who's talking to the medium. And the first thing you say to the medium is you give the first name of the person you're trying to connect with, right?
Sorry, yeah. So during the reading, all the medium and I have is the first name of the discarnate. So we start the reading and I give the first name.
Great. And that's a good point, too. That's all you have.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have any information because we're substituting you here as we said as a pronoun here, but it's not really you. You wouldn't be the person who decided who the two participants were, or who the two deceased people that we're trying to connect with. You would be blind to that, right?
A different experimenter does the pairing and screens the sitters. And it's my research assistant, Michael. So Michael gets on the phone with all the sitters. He gathers all the information. He does all the pairing. And then I say, okay, I'm ready to do two readings. And he gives me a first name.
Great. So you sit down there and you say, Miss Medium, I don't know anything else other than I have a person here who wants to connect with someone named Sarah. Ready, go.
Mm-hmm.
And now they go. So you're blind to it. They're blind to it. The reading happens. Now, tell us a little bit about what happens after the reading has occurred, the transcribing, and the reporting on that.
So let's back up a little more even. So during the reading, I give the medium the first name, and they're allowed to just give some general information for about 10 minutes. And then I ask those same four specific questions. Describe the physical appearance of the discarnate. Describe their personalities. What were their hobbies, or how did they spend their time, and what was their cause of death?
Okay, good point. So even in that part, though, so for 10 minutes you go, okay, medium, go ahead. What are you getting, Sarah? And they can just say anything. Mm-hmm. And then you take them through a very targeted, which is also a very important difference with the way that the prior medium research at the University of Arizona was done. So the one big difference that we pointed out at the beginning is now we're targeting one specific deceased person. We're really not interested in information that comes through on other deceased people. And number two, we're targeting in on certain specific bits of information that we want. What did they look like? Build, height, hair. What was their personality? Introverted, extroverted, hobbies, cause of death. These are really specific things that you are now asking without knowing what the answer should be or could be. You're just asking the medium for responses to those, right?
Correct.
Now the reading ends. What happens next?
So then I'm still blinded. I still don't know anything. So I take the I take the recording of the reading and I turn it into a list of single individual items of the information that the medium provided. And so part of that formatting process is if the medium makes any reference to the name that I gave, then I pull out all of those references and I pull out all the maybes and the could be's. And so if the medium says, I think maybe I'm sort of getting that she might have had red hair, my item is she had red hair. Because you can't say whether she maybe had red hair, if that's true or not. And we're asking the sitters, is this true or not? I'm not totally versed in every single mediumship study that ever existed on the planet. But I don't think that's I think that's relatively uncommon. I think that's a newer protocol.
Great. So now you're formatting a transcript. So first you get it all transcript, and then you're formatting it down to these single declarative kind of statements of facts.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of things that you mentioned, just to be clear, if I said you're doing a reading for Sarah, you would take out obviously any references to the name Sarah, because that would tip off that that's who the reading was for.
Exactly.
And then you have these number of other things, like you said, you kind of take out, you make the statements clear, you take out any kind of medium speak of, give me an example of some of the medium speak.
I think I wrote a paper that I wrote about all this methodology just came out in the Journal of Parapsychology. And I think the example I use in that paper is like a medium might say, I'm getting that Sarah is below the sitter, then that means that they're younger, they're in a younger generation. And if they say, you know, they're to the side of, that means they're in the same generation, or above is a generation older. So I put brackets and I sort of define what the medium speak means to the sitter.
Okay. And this isn't something you came up with. This is just something, a shorthand way of talking that the medium has that you're translating for the benefit of the sitter.
It's language that mediums use naturally, and then I define it for the sitter.
Okay, great. So now let's get down to the payoff here. Now you've done a couple of readings with you being the intermediary. You've transcribed them, broken them down into these single or a list of kind of declarative statements. Her hair is red. She passed away this way. She was introverted. She liked this, blah, blah, blah. Now what happens?
So now I send those two readings, and they're just numbered reading one and two. I send those to a third experimenter, Mark, and then Mark, and I say, these two readings are for these two discarnates of we'll name them in groups. So Michael says, here are two names in group A. So then we do the readings, and then I send the two readings, the two blinded readings, to Mark, and I say, these are the two readings from group A. But he doesn't know which one is for which name, and he sends them to the sitters for scoring. So now none of us can accidentally convey anything to anybody because we don't know anything to convey.
So now the next person in this chain, who you said is Mark, Mark gets the two readings and he sits down with me and says, okay, Alex, you want to connect with your grandmother, Sarah. Here are two readings. I don't know which one is for your grandmother, Sarah, but one of them is, and one is for another person. And then I'm asked to do what?
So he doesn't sit down with you. He emails the readings to you. And you okay. And Michael has previously trained you on how to do the scoring. So Mark sends you two readings. You already know how to do the scoring. And by yourself, you score each of the readings and you email back your scores.
Okay. And basically, how am I scoring these?
So you have the list of items. So you score each item for how we say, you know, think to yourself, how well does this piece of information fit? So it's a numerical, you can give it a numerical score, and they're not, 5 isn't one better than 4. They're just named 0 through 5. So 5 is obvious fit. It's a concrete hit. 4 is fit requiring minimal interpretation to fit. Like they almost got it. It's, you know, that's pretty close. 3 is a fit requiring maximum interpretation, like, yeah, I guess if you really squinted your eyes, that might be right. And then 2 is it doesn't fit the person whose name the reading was for, but it fits somebody else. And 1 is no fit, that's totally wrong. And 0 is I don't know. I don't know. I don't have the information to know whether that's right or wrong. And then when we do the analysis, we use scores as 4 or 5 as hits. And all the rest of them we consider misses. And then you also give the whole reading a score from 0 to 6, which is a different scale. And that scale is based on the work of Russell Targ and Jane Catra. That's a scoring that they developed for remote viewing, like how you would score a remote viewer's picture or response. And then as a third way of quote scoring, we say pick which reading you think is yours. So you have this item by item, you know, percent of accurate items data, and then you have a whole reading 0 to 6 score of the reading, and then you have a binary, is it or is, you know, yes or no, is this your reading? And so you can do statistics on each one of those pieces of data.
Right. The reason you can, again, is because the whole process we went through, it's just like me sitting down with these random facts that I have no idea where they came from, and I have to pick whether they fit, whether they match, rate them on a scale of how well they fit, and then come up with an overall evaluation. So at this point, we've kind of addressed, I think, let's go back to the points we were talking about a few minutes ago. The judging bias now and the control group bias are both addressed. What was the complaint or the criticism, and there was some validity to it, of the previous objection to the judging bias?
Well, if you know the reading is yours, rater biases, if you know the reading is yours, you may have a tendency to score it as either more or less accurate than it is in reality. But if you don't know which one is yours, you'll score them with the same, quote, amount of bias.
Right. So if this is the reading that I got back, I might want to please either the medium or the experimenter, or I might want to displease either the medium or the experimenter, or it might just be human nature that I want to cooperate. I want to get along. Yeah. So I start seeing things in a certain way. And that's kind of out of the equation now, because I now have no knowledge of which one of these readings pertain to me. And there's no way I could have any knowledge.
Right. So if you score a bunch of things as right, you'll score a bunch of things as right in both of the readings. And so statistically that will cancel out. And if you score both things low, statistically that will cancel out. What the statistic looks for is the difference between the two. Not she got 77% right. That doesn't matter. It's what the difference is between the scores given by the sitters to their own readings and the scores that they gave to someone else's readings without knowing which was which.
Great. And what about the medium, who is giving a lot of generalities to their answers and are just kind of fishing around? How does that not affect this process?
Well, we're asking for specific information, so they can't just give general, because we're asking for specific pieces of information. And if they just give general, you know, he's kind of short but kind of tall, that's two items now. He's kind of short and he's kind of tall. And so a medium that just provided general information, one, would have a low accuracy percentage, and the sitter would have a lot of trouble discerning between the two readings. So they probably would have a low record of the sitter's choice.
And what you'd wind up with at the end of the day is chance, is sitters picking readings and basically picking them at chance levels, 50-50 kind of scores. Or if you're saying, how, what score would you give it, a 1 through a 6, everyone's going to be at the 3 kind of middle ground. And that's not in the published research that you've done, published back in 2006.
2007.
I'm sorry. But you did it in 2006, published it in January of 2007, correct?
I think we probably did it in 2005, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Because I think the chronology is really important. I want to get back to this later, but this is work that has been out there for a while. So you published it in January of 2006. It's not like we're springing something on people here that...
January 2007.
I'm sorry, January 2007.
Right. So it's almost 2 years old now.
Almost 2 years old. So in that published study, I think you had 16 mm-hmm. times mm-hmm. where people had to choose
right.
which reading is mine.
Right.
And what percentage of time did they choose the correct reading?
81%. So 13 of those 16 people.
And that's a pretty impressive, I assume that was statistically significant, if I remember correctly from the paper.
Yes, it's quite significant. Like, you're looking for a p-value of less than 0.05, and I think that p was 0.001.
Okay, well, with that in mind, now we've gone back, and I hope that isn't too detailed and exhaustive for people, but I just think that's fascinating. I think the whole process is extremely tight, in my opinion, and I'm certainly open to, I'm not a scientist, and I'm open to other people and people who are critical of your work to come forward and say where the gaping flaws and holes are, but it sure seems to me like it's addressed the main issues. With that in mind, let me go back and play a couple more clips from Ben's interview last episode, and then in light of what we now know and have talked about, let's hear what you might have to say about a couple of these, okay?
Mm-hmm. I do know about the research. One of the issues it doesn't address is that in many of these cases, the verification of the information is provided by the sitter. That is, this is not information that's supposedly coming from the gray beyond that is verified by a third-party person. Much of this is information where the medium will say, I'm getting information from, you know, your husband or your grandfather, whatever else, and the information is judged either accurate or inaccurate by the sitter, and there's an inherent problem right there that has not been addressed.
And I just want to remind people that I specifically said, you know, Julie Beischel is on the show, and she's done this new research, and he responded, yeah, I'm familiar with that research. So just as a grounding, that's where we're all coming from on that. So what are your thoughts on that?
So I'm going to use that our current peer-reviewed methods to address that. So, you know, he's saying he's listing as a criticism the fact that the sitter is the person that judges the information as accurate or inaccurate. So it's important to keep in mind the scope and the goal of the research. So the goal isn't to prove the existence of an afterlife. Anyone on my team would say we're not trying to prove an afterlife. That is not the goal. What we're doing is examining the process of mediumship in its natural environment with the proper controls. So normal readings between a medium and a sitter. And again, the general hypothesis we're testing is, can mediums report accurate and specific information without any prior knowledge and in the absence of any sensory feedback? So with that being the goal, the sitter has to be the person that is the judge, because the information was intended for the sitter. And we don't ask the hypothesized discarnate. I'm just going to put an asterisk. Every time I say discarnate, I mean hypothesized discarnate. I'm not implying we have established that the medium is talking to a dead person, because we haven't. So the hypothesized discarnate, we don't ask the hypothesized discarnate to, you know, take an algebra exam and provide information a third party could determine is accurate. That's not what a mediumship reading is. We're asking them to communicate with their friends and family, the only people who can determine if the information is correct and applicable.
Okay, now just to clear, that's a good, very, very good point. And just to clarify where I think Ben was coming from, one of the criticisms of the prior research done at the University of Arizona is that if a person comes through and says, oh, I think I'm connecting with an aunt figure and her name is Dolly, then the person who is accepting the reading can say, yeah, that's right. And then there isn't the independent verification of whether that's right or wrong that was troubling to some skeptics.
Right, because how could you verify whether or not something was wrong about my entire life? I couldn't tell you everything you need to know to do that. I don't know how that's even possible.
You've gotten around that whole issue by how? How have you specifically kind of addressed this issue of that there is someone there who's making these subjective judgments about the accuracy of the data?
Well, we're controlling for rater bias by having the person score two blinded readings, and we're comparing their score of a reading intended for them to their score of a reading not intended for them.
Right. So the big problem before is, as the skeptics will point out, and in some cases very correctly, is that the reading could pile up like positive points, like that's a hit, that's another hit, that's another hit. Oh, your percent is going up and up and up. And now what you've done is kind of taken that out of the equation, because it really doesn't matter how high or how accurate any particular reading is. It's more of a comparison. How does this reading compare with the other reading? And that's how you've really, I think, in a very novel way, controlled for this whole idea of rater bias. They're biased. They can be biased one way or another way, but it's going to wash out with the control reading that they have.
Right, because they'll be the same bias for each reading, because they won't know which is theirs.
Here's the next quote from Ben.
Part of the problem here is that those descriptions that you just gave, those can still be vague. Someone says, you know, the person that's coming through is a tall man with gray hair. Well, it turns out that when the person died, he was bald. Again, this gets back to the problem of having the sitter verify the information, because if the sitter says, yes, he had gray hair, then that's a hit. That's good information. But the medium could also say he was bald, in which case the sitter would say, well, you know, he had gray hair, but then in his last years, you know, he was bald. So, you know, you can have a medium giving two contradictory pieces of information, both of which would be considered a hit by the sitter.
Okay, and I think we've probably covered that, but go ahead.
So I think this is important just to address, and then I'll get to that specifically. So ideally, laboratory-based mediumship research has to include two things. One, an environment that optimizes the process for everyone involved, the medium, the hypothesized discarnate, the sitter, in order to increase the probability of capturing the phenomenon if it exists. And two, methods that maximize the blinding to control for any conventional explanations for the information. So together, those two factors optimize the possibility of achieving positive results while also controlling for experimental artifacts. So
hold on, wait.
I have a real world example that will make that much more understandable.
Okay,
so we use this metaphor. You can't study football on a basketball court using baseball players and the rules for hockey. Because if you get negative results, you can't say I've disproven the phenomenon of football in that case, because you were on a basketball court using baseball players and the rules for hockey. So you can't, that's not a proper experiment. Similarly, it's not appropriate to claim that, you know, Jason Elam can kick a 95-yard field goal if you give him a Nerf football, an empty stadium and no defensive line. That's not real football either. In order to study football appropriately, only trained, skilled participants and the regulation equipment, environment, and regulations can be used. The same thing is true for mediumship. So negative results from a study using methods that didn't optimize the environment and positive maximized blinding are equally ineffective as establishing new knowledge.
And this goes back to what you've been calling a naturalistic or a natural setting. It tries to put everyone in the position that they are when people report these fantastic readings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so common sense. And yet, it gets so mixed up in the mind of skeptics so many times when I hear it. It's that it goes back to your initial research hypothesis or proposition. If we're going to study, is medium communication real? Shouldn't we do everything possible to let the medium and the sitter have at it in the way that they feel most comfortable, with the only caveat being that we want to put the proper experimental controls on it? I mean, that just seems like common sense to me.
Yeah. And some people call that, oh, you're cheating then because you're optimizing. But it's the same thing as saying if you give the football player a football instead of a watermelon, or, you know, it's not cheating. It's optimizing so you can watch the process as it takes place take place. And I think people fail to understand that proper research design includes optimizing the possibility of achieving positive results. If you wanted to study plant growth, you don't put a dry seed on the benchtop in the lab and then say, plants can't grow. And, you know, you right. use soil and water right. and sunlight, and then you study the growth of the seed.
Right. Do everything possible. Once you've put the proper controls in place, why not do everything possible to recreate the phenomena? I completely agree. Now, what about Ben's point about the information being vague? Maybe I say the hair was black, but I was bald older. I mean, you know, that thing.
Okay, so I think his main point was that two pieces of contradictory information can be judged as hits by the sitter. And so, again, we have to keep in mind the process of mediumship. So first, the medium is interpreting images, symbols, sounds, you know, whatever. So she actually may receive two items that appear contradictory, but we instruct them to say what you see. That's the process, and we're studying the process. So we have to, you know, we can't mess with the process. Second, as is often the case, as anyone who has ever been in a relationship can attest, communication between people is not black and white. And things can be contradictory and accurate at the same time.
So then let's follow that piece of information or those seemingly contradictory pieces of information through your protocol and see what happens at the end and see if they do create this mix up in the final judging of the data. So the person says, black hair, bald. Two things that are contradictory. Mm-hmm. Older in life, they were bald. Earlier in life, they had black hair. How do you score it? How do you report it? And then how does the sitter score it?
So we're not asking the medium to describe a photo of the discarnate. We're asking them to describe aspects of the whole entire dynamic lifespan of the person. So just like that's entirely accurate for the person to be bald at some points in their life and dark hair in some points of their life, and they may discarnate may present themselves to the medium in each of those ways, and it's accurate for the sitter to score each of those items as accurate because they are both accurate. And during scoring, again, we're not ranking up the number of hits. We're comparing the number of hits to the number of hits in a control reading. So if the medium always, you know, if in one reading she says, well, he was bald at some point and he had dark hair at some point, and then the other reading says, well, he's bald at some point, but he was blonde at some point. Then those two times that she said bald cancel each other out because they're counted as hits in the control group and in the intended group.
Great, which is really the important distinction that we want to make. Okay, next clip from Ben Radford's critique of your work.
Okay, tell you what, use subjects who do not fit what most people would consider to be a normal profile. So, you know, so have a subject who maybe lost his legs in an accident during the war.
Well, I think we've hit this.
Well, I actually did want to address that specifically. Again, we have to keep in mind the scope of the research. We're not setting up a condition where the discarnate has to prove something. We're interested in studying mediumship under conditions that exist normally. So that is where the medium provides information allowing the sitter to identify the discarnate.
I think where he was going was just to say, let's get people that are different so that those differences are highlighted in the reading. And that's the first thing that you do. And I just want to bring us back to that and make it clear that.
Yeah. And then another issue with that is that even if we did that, it would be very difficult, right? Because there aren't a whole lot of people in the world who have lost their legs or have a birth defect or whatever.
And I don't even
so
think.
So it's a very small. Yeah, it's a very small percentage of people. And even if you did that experiment where all the people had something special about them, then all you could conclude at the end of the day was mediums can report specific and accurate information about special deceased people. Well, we're not interested in right. that study. We're interested in where, how does mediumship work in its natural environment?
And let me go ahead and really go out a limb here and speak for Ben Radford, which is, but I think where he was going was just taking the mundane out of it, which is kind of the next quote that I wanted to play for you. And I think they're related. I think he's saying, you know, let's look at people who are different, and not, because I think incorrectly on his part, he had this vision that all these readings are being done for 80-year-old grandmothers who passed away, you know, and you're doing just the opposite of that. So let me play this next quote, because I think it relates back to exactly what we're talking about here.
Okay.
Well, I mean, part of my problem with the whole notion of mediumistic communication is that a lot of the stuff is so mundane.
Okay, I have one word, football. Like, that's like saying, oh, I don't like watching football because the players don't fly. Well, that's not how football works. So we have to keep in mind how the process works. And we've actually found mediums most often report three kinds of information. Information that allows the sitter to identify the discarnate. So I call that, it's me, it's me. And events that have occurred since the discarnate's passing. I'm here, I'm here, I'm still here. I saw you at that birthday party, or I saw that you got married, or whatever. Like, I'm still in your life, even though I've died. And then three, messages of an emotional nature. I love you. So we also have to keep in mind the scope of the research. We're not looking to prove the existence of an afterlife. We're interested in the phenomenon of mediumship. Mundane or not, the information is meaningful to the sitter. And that's what we're studying. I think it's also important to recognize that the majority of all human communication is mundane. I like to say we study human communication. One of the people just happens to be dead. And you don't study normal human communication by asking people to, you know, talk about quantum physics. You just ask them to talk to each other. And that's what we're doing.
And of course, what's mundane for one person or another or a third observer is incredibly relevant to an individual. I can say from my personal experience with a reading using just kind of the very basic of control, so it's not like a scientific reading, some information that I would tell, that I could report to you about that reading would seem incredibly mundane and to me was mm-hmm. deeply, deeply meaningful, almost to the point of bringing me to tears in terms of how relevant that was to me on an emotional level. So,
and I think that brings up another point. Like, I think Mr. Radford said something about that, like he was saying, oh, well, if the medium just says the discarnate says he loves you, and he literally said, what value is that? Again, let's remember what we're studying. It's a deceased person communicating with the people that they loved who are grieving and suffering and missing him, not, you know, a graduate student defending their dissertation. So what would you say to your family if you had died and you could witness their mourning? I would say, I love you. I think the mistake here, again, is that we're trying to prove an afterlife, and we're not. We want to look at a mediumship reading with normal people receiving normal messages from their normal deceased relatives. That's what we study. And I think critics think mediumship readings contain life-altering or extraordinary pieces of information, but that's like expecting those types of information to show up in phone calls or letters or emails from someone that you haven't been able to talk to for a while. To an outsider, like you said, the information may seem mundane, but it's really meaningful to the person receiving it. And I actually want to correct something you said in that interview, Alex. You said we don't score I love you as accurate. But after we have the medium answer those four specific questions about the discarnate's physical life, we honor the sitter and the discarnate by asking the medium, does the discarnate have any messages for the sitter? This provides motivation for the sitter to participate and the discarnate to participate, and not just to have to jump through our hoops. You know, hey, dead person, show up for our study and answer these questions and then go away. Like, this may be the only opportunity they have to convey important messages to their deceased or to their living relatives. So those messages items are scored in the same way that the other items are. But again, we compare the control. So if they always said, I love you, it'd be right in the control reading and in the intended reading, and it would wash out. But I also want to make the point that I love you is not an automatic hit.
Right.
If the medium said, I love you, that my mom was saying, I love you, I would score it as wrong, because we never said that in my family. And I would say, you must be talking to the wrong person, because my mom would never say that. Great point. It's not like when someone says, I love you, that's an automatic hit, because not everybody would say that.
Great point, and thanks for that clarification. Okay, so in wrapping up all of the comments that Ben had about your research, we have one more that we've touched on, but let me play it one more time and have you address it directly.
I mean, I have yet, and if you can point me to an example of this, I'll be happy to follow it up and write it down and say that I was wrong. But I have yet to find a case either in Psi research generally or in Gary Schwartz's experiments specifically that have information that neither the medium nor the sitter knew.
Okay, so the final clip, thoughts on that?
So I think I did address that. Again, we're not trying to prove an afterlife. We want to study mediumship under its normal condition. And there have been cases where the medium often, I've heard mediums say a reading doesn't happen without the discarnate providing information that the sitter didn't know because it's the most evidential for the sitter. But it's not evidential in the lab because it doesn't separate telepathy from survival as explanations. So it's not ideal. It's not something we would look to collect because it doesn't answer any question.
Okay, what would be the best way for Skeptico to put together some examples for Ben to see where this has occurred? Taking out the survival issue and just saying, is another person able to connect with information that the receiving person didn't know about?
I think when you do your demonstration, you can specifically, we did a small pilot study where we specifically used the question, please provide information that is unknown to the sitter, medium, or experimenter and can be verified later.
Okay.
And so you can, and a lot of the mediums said they do that every time anyway. So you can specifically ask for that type of information and then specifically follow up with the sitter. I would suggest that because, again, we haven't done it officially in a controlled way. So I don't have data on that.
Great. Well, we'll do that.
I just can tell you it happened. I've seen it. I don't have any specific examples because we haven't looked at it specifically.
Okay, Julie, well, that takes care of the clips that I wanted to play from Ben's interview. But there was one other point that came up, and it's really my mistake or my issue that needs clarifying. And that has to do with the editorial process at the JSC, the Journal for Scientific Exploration. And I've kind of danced around this in the past. And then after our last broadcast, I got an email from both Dean Radin, which I want to read a little bit from in a minute. And then I also wanted to ask you about the editorial process at the Journal for Scientific Exploration, because you are very familiar with it.
Yeah, I found it to be one of the most stringent peer review processes of any journal I've submitted papers to. I think Dean said his recollection was only roughly 10% of the papers submitted to the JSC are accepted and published. That's the same rate as for the journal Science. So it's not like they are just accepting and publishing everything they get. 90% of papers that are submitted to the JSC get rejected.
Great, great. I think that's good information to get out there. And then I also wanted to include Dean Radin's comment because he was nice enough to send me an email and try and clarify it as well. And here's what he writes. In your interview with Ben Radford, the JSC is mentioned with some uncertainty about its peer review process. I'm an associate editor for the JSC, and I serve as a referee for a dozen other journals ranging from mainstream psychology and physics to complementary and alternative medicine. I can tell you that among the half dozen associate editors for the JSC, collectively, we act as referees for at least 20 mainstream journals in disciplines ranging from astrophysics to zoology. At JSC, we use the same standards applied for articles submitted to any other journal. So JSC is completely mainstream as to its peer review. It's just that the topics are not mainstream. So I think that should clear up, both for me and for anyone else, this idea of the peer review process at the Journal for Scientific Exploration being somehow lacking. It's clearly not. And in this game, scientific peer review, we have to accept that the same people we're respecting enough to treat as editors on a wide variety of mainstream journals are doing the same job on the JSE that they're doing on these other journals. And therefore, there really isn't any credible reason to discount the value of an article published in the JSE. You had something else to add to that as well, Julie.
Speaking of, you know, journals and peer review and such, there's a journal called Psychological Science, and it's one of the top 10 psychology journals in the world. And we actually submitted that triple blind paper to Psychological Science first, and the editor rejected it without even sending it out for peer review. And the reason he gave was, quote, there's nothing new here. So then we submitted it to Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, and there it was peer-reviewed and published. And so I want to, when critics list the fact that these types of studies are not published in more mainstream journals as a drawback of the research, it's not really a criticism of the work. You know, it's not that the material being produced by PSI researchers is not of a high enough quality to be published in those journals. It's often the case that the journals refuse to publish them. And you know, I'm not saying, of course, that all PSI research studies are stellar, but the reality is that a bias exists that often prevents even the really good studies from being published.
Okay, well, Julie, we've really taken a lot of time. Thanks again for spending so much time with us and joining us. And I do hope that I can close the loop with Ben Radford. I want to bring him in and get his response, bring him up to date on what you're saying and hear what he has to say about it and hopefully get a dialogue going. Because I think that, you know, I get the sense in talking to Ben that it wasn't deliberate on his part in terms of him not understanding the research. And I have to admit that I didn't fully understand it. So let's just try and bring everybody up to date and then see where we're at that point.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's really great that you've brought these, you know, historically separate and warring sides of scientists and skeptics together, because as a scientist, I'm always thankful for intelligent criticism of the work. You know, educated and constructive analyses only make it stronger.
Great. Okay, well, then we will be back in touch. And thanks again, Julie.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Julie Beischel for joining me today on Skeptico. As usual, if you'd like to check out any of the links associated with this show or check out our previous shows, visit our website at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to our forum and an email link where you can drop me a note if you like. Until next time, that's going to do it. Bye for now. Sorriso por aí que me diz que o teu destino é só amanhã. Tem alguém que diz que vai, mas...